Welcome to Naked Word Radio, and part the third of the curious chronicle of the lost heart, in which we look at the disadvantages of having advantage, the joy of music and the despair of mechanical process. We barely brush the subject of trust, but paint it with an unusual honesty. And this is called Sleeping with the Enemy, a Thorn in the Flesh. The new day is grey. A pale wintry wash of rain-smeared sky obscures what little dawn there could be. The cold in the stone step leaches through to my backside and I stand up, tipping my cigarette end into the bin. I'm in some kind of automatic mode, barely aware of what I am doing. Rinse my mug and a stray thought wanders through my mind. I failed once again to take my tea without sugar. Turn off the TV, put my jacket on, lock the door, get in car, roll a light cigarette. I'm fighting myself. My whole being just wants to go back to bed and sleep the day away. My reason overcomes my feelings every day, herds me to work in Her Majesty's Hotel, the nearby prison. Habit struts, parades like a peacock through my emotions, except that each and every day there are less feathers to hide behind. I pull into the car park that sprawls in front of the grimly designed institutional building. The architect has tried, but dismally failed, to disguise the fact that this is a prison. Lock wallet and phone in the car, queue to exchange my tag for a bunch of keys so big they have to sit in a leather pouch. On this day, there's a search. All staff are shuffled into line, waiting to be sniffed by a dog, frisked by a warden, and bag emptied over the table. And all the time that sneaks by eats into the coffee break before the working day begins, the late prep for lessons, the banter with colleagues, and most of all, my sanity. The anti-institution man finds himself buried in one of the most difficult institutions you would ever want to imagine. Hostility in a jail is a tangible force. It flows sluggish and intractable like monolithic blood, grinding corridor floors a steel grey smooth. These passageways are the veins and arteries of a prison, and on this drab bleak day I lean my way down the corridors that are crowded with men, most of them in their tired grey uniform, chucking grenades of conversation over their shoulders. Some men, dressed in black, mark strategic positions and stand, sombre, serious and stationary, in the tide of men striding past them. A thought wanders through my mind that I am moving in the midst of a startle of starlings being minded by a caution of crows. My path today takes me to a more obscure part of the site. The wire mesh encased passageway leads me beside an immaculate lawn, punched along the edges by exactly spaced flower beds. Geraniums nod their head in obedience to some invisible force, as do I when I unlock the gate and report to the office. Some silent intuition hints at trouble in the air, but these days I find it hard to find certainty in anything, at work or home. It could just be my imagination, which can easily go into overdrive, but I notice a certain hesitancy on the face of one warder, who looks to the only other warder in the room. This one stands up and walks towards me, his face a mask of concern. "Well, we thought you weren't coming, so the governor sent them to work." I look up at the clock on the wall. Even though I'd been held up, it was still only 9, exactly the time when lessons begin. I realise that the chemistry has changed, a subtle tipping of the scales away from my favour. Something is afoot, and even if I knew what it was, there would be very little I could do about it. "Oh, and," the warder continued, "there's a message from him." I look at him expectantly, head tilted, waiting and wondering what little bombshell awaits. He reaches into his pocket, taking out tobacco and papers. "Smoke?" he asks. I decline his offer but roll my own and follow him down the stairs and into the garden. Rain is really falling now and we huddle in the narrow shelter provided by the wall. Well, at least he does. I am somehow manoeuvred into the fat, heavy drops and wish I'd put my jacket on. "The governor says you'll have to cancel the concert on this wing." "Cancel?" I question. "Why?" "Well, He tells me that we need a public entertainment's license. The enormity and obvious irrelevance of this statement doesn't seem to occur to the warder, who dismisses any further questions by grinding out his cigarette butt on the wall and opening the door to go back inside. I follow him up the stairs, a seemingly unending climb to nowhere. No students this morning, sent to work instead of music lessons, and no concert for the men next month. My mind is emptying, any sensible thoughts swirling like water out of the sink. Now I know I should have stayed in bed. I find myself trembling into flight mode. I walk the empty corridors, uncertain as to where I should go. I can't return to the office. That makes public that I've failed my students. Well, that's how I feel about it. I can't sit outside. There's no shelter. Finally, I choose to return to the little staff room, away from the main office. All the teachers are busy, and if any of them do return before the end of lessons, I'm sure I'll think of an explanation as to why I am there. I try to settle in the chair behind a desk, get a book out to read, but my mind is everywhere, darting in and out of thoughts, like an anxious hummingbird seeking the nectar of understanding. The irony of hiding inside the nick is not lost on me, but is overshadowed by the realization that everything that the men and I have worked for has now been terminated. I've lost count of all the mornings that I have threaded my way through the tired arteries of this institution, passed by the pointless cloisters studded here and there, their only purpose seeming to be as a collection point for cigarette butts. They remind me of my school, but there at least I could get an impression of a garden placed within the confines of the buildings, a point of inspiration, a refreshing glimpse of the sky. Despite all this gloom, I know that the music room for me and my students is a haven, an oasis in a cultural desert. Buried deep as a dungeon in the prison complex, it is often a thorn in the flesh of the authorities with its glass partition cubicles, ancient sweaty carpets stained by neglect, and failed and failing equipment. You cannot escape the aroma of insufficiently washed bodies overlaid with cheap aftershave and deodorant, or the pervasive background tobacco impregnated into the fabric of the room. It can be so strong that teachers unused to working in the music room accuse the men of smoking in there. I know this is ridiculous, because a place on the music course is so treasured that not even the most arrogant and stupid inmate would lose their place through lighting up. I'm still in the little staff room, dodging the reality inflicted on me by the cold heart of the system. With half an eye on the clock as it edges towards lunchtime, I follow the cascade of thoughts tumbling through my mind and settle, like the pictures on a fruit machine, on one in particular. The staff room door opens and a colleague walks in, dumping her bag on the floor and slumping herself in a chair. I've had a real shit of a morning. Sometimes I wish that none of the men will show up, and I can have a nice, quiet morning. How's yours been? The next morning brings the usual dilemma. I go through all the familiar but unwelcome motions. In the car, the wipers clear the windscreen, but my mind is a blur, driven by the fear of the consequences of not going to work. I drive through the estate, turn into the main road, but a strange thing happens as I come up to the industrial park, a mile from home. I find myself in a different automatic mode. Turn left, then sharp right, and back towards home. Never have I felt so relieved as I unlocked the front door. The sweet tea and one paper spliff never tasted so good, even on a cold doorstep. For the last three working days of the week, my partner is not at home, so explaining why I'm not going to work is not an issue. I can feel it brewing in importance, but also feel incapable of dealing with it. She will have to know, and I know that she will be supportive, but still I am afraid to say anything. Even the tiniest things seem immensely difficult to deal with. I struggle to decide if I want tea or coffee. And phoning the staff office in the morning to explain my absence is very hard. I have to pretend not only to have a heavy cold, but almost to be someone else. Otherwise, I am convinced that they will see straight through me. I find that I have absolutely no confidence in myself and have lost the ability to decide or discern anything. Well, I do tell my partner. She, of course, has sensible advice. So in the following week, I find myself in the doctor's surgery talking to a pleasant and understanding Scot with the soft tones of the West Coast. Photos of his family perched on the windowsill beside a family of elephants of varying sizes. The sun is bright on the wall outside and set in stripes by the horizontal slats of the blinds masking the window. His gentle approach tries to find the reason why I am there, but I cannot find the place to begin. I hear myself waffling along and wonder what I am talking about. The doctor's delicate probing finally picks out the stone holding back the stream of my confusion, and suddenly a torrent of tears and understanding is released. I am relieved to discover that I am simply suffering from depression. Simply seems to be an understatement of some magnitude. However, to find out that I am not going mad leaves me both numb and exhilarated. I sense a flood of feelings about to be unleashed, and I'm afraid that I will be overwhelmed. I leave the surgery with arguments for and against medication, a local mental health helpline, but most importantly, with a sick note for a month. I'm sitting in the garden room. The day is warm enough to open the French doors, but the sunlight is a pale watercolour wash. My brain is struggling with the mechanics of depression and whether it's a blessing or not that there is a physical cause. Hands folded in my lap, slumped in my chair, I watch a bumblebee fly in the open door. Scientists have decided that it's aerodynamically impossible for a bee to fly, and certainly their aerial progress always seems erratic, but no one can indeed deny that they do travel through the air. However, finding its way out again is another problem to solve, and before long I get up, catch the bee with a glass and a piece of paper, letting it out into the garden. I can relate to the bee's sense of freedom after the momentary confusion of being trapped, and with a wry smile wish that a hand of a deity might reach down and release me. There are men in prison, kept on the wrong side of the door and unable to find their way out. I remember one young man, cheerfully enthusiastic, but with his own particular view of the world, who seemed to exit prison and enter the street through a revolving door. He had no skills that could be used legally, and no reason or incentive to be otherwise. A friendly, but hyperactive man, he somehow kept his place in the queue to join the music class, despite his frequent absences. The first time I meet him, I'm in the prison at my desk on a Monday morning in the music room, signing people in as they enter, reminding them of whose turn it is on the various items of equipment we have that still work. I'm always impressed how understanding the men are of these shortages. I have taught art, English and cooking here as well, and have seen these people kick off if there's a shortage of anything. Suddenly, there's a tall, spare and gangly man leaning over me, inspecting the register. "I'm not on there. I am supposed to be here." I look up at him, mentally slowing him down, but already not expecting it to have any effect. Many of the men greet him as they come in. One addresses me. "No peace now, boss. Not now we got Tom." Well, there's a clue. I pull a sheet of paper out from under the register, and sure enough, there is a Tom listed. "That's me. Mark me in," he insists, placing his finger squarely on his name. "Okay, Tom. But there's a form for you to fill in. If you wait a moment, I'll find one for you." "Cheers, Pete," he says and pulls up a chair, placing it on the corner beside me. He couldn't get any closer without sharing my chair. It's no surprise that he knows my name. Like in any community, all of the teachers get discussed, for better or worse, and I long ago gave up wondering what was said about me. I find the entrance form he has to deal with, but he has left the chair, exploring all the corners of the music room, and returns with a guitar. I take the bull by its erratic horns, knowing that the chances of controlling Tom are fairly slender, but there are and will be indisputable boundaries between the men and me. I ask him to move the chair back to where it originally came from, and he sits on it, wildly strumming on the guitar, placing his left-hand fingers in a variety of interesting positions on the frets. I show him a chord on the guitar, and once I feel he's remembered the finger positions, I go on my rounds, reminding him to fill in the form. Predictably, he doesn't fill in the form for some days. And here ends part 3, Sleeping with the Enemy, A Thorn in the Flesh.